7th, and we'll get right to our agenda. If anybody has anything, it's like Representative Backlund, nothing for the good of the order there, Representative Backlund.
I'm just waiting with anticipation.
Are you, I knew you would be.
What we're going to do.
I knew you would be.
In a few moments.
It sounds good. And with that, we're going to just go in order of the bills that we have here, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2482. And if our new committee administrator, at least for this first part of the week, we'll get a little rundown on the bill, that'd be appreciated.
Sure. Chair Knope, members of the committee, House Bill 2482 decreases the percent of votes from 75% to 67% to amend a homeowners association declaration. It also increases the number of homeowners association members required for a quorum from 20% to 50% unless the homeowners association bylaws provide otherwise.
Thank you. And with that, we have Tom Satterley, I believe, who's here. So come on up, Tom, and give us your name for the record and tell us what you think.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Satterley. I live at 153012 Wagon Trail Road in Lapine, a subdivision which is in Klamath County, a planned subdivision put forth by Brooks Resources. The bill that we have in front of us, I guess, to some degree, is a part of the work of the chairman of our committee or of our board of directors. And I apologize, I've never been here before. I didn't realize that you needed copies of my information, so I won't read it. I will just tell you what I think and apologize again. Next time I come, I'll bring 16 copies, so please excuse me. I'm concerned about decreasing any voting requirement for the passage of any change in our current CCNRs or bylaws because of things that I see happening today currently under the existing laws of the land. And by that I mean we have boards in our regular, in our group, and I'm not speaking about anybody else but just our own, who have managed within the last 60 days to cut down 8 old growth trees 48 inches in diameter up to 72 inches in diameter to pay for their escapades hiring an attorney to fight a member on the ranch. That cutting down is now being pursued in law, in court, against the board at the request of about 90 members of our association who are the only ones who have returned their vows so far, because it clearly says, according to the attorney and according to the reading of Section 94, that you cannot touch the common property without an approval of 75% of the members voting or capable of voting. If these people will do that, if they will overspend their budget, if they will stack the regulations that speak to maintaining a piece of property without mobile homes on it as is defined by deed restriction, if they'll do that and a whole piece of other things, we don't need to give them the opportunity to take away the rights we currently have. I think that if you were a property owner there and had bought back in 1974 and had left the state and came today to see what you bought, you would be devastated. You would see roads that have gone to disrepair, broken windows, pools that are not safe, clubhouses that are antiquated. While we spend money defending the board against board or against members whose rights have been trampled on, you would not recognize the subdivision because of the things that they have done. Past chairman of the board in about 1989 wrote a memo to the membership. We are hereby reversing the CCNRs and allowing mobile homes to be placed any place on the ranch. And so here came the mobile homes against deed restrictions. The neighbors on the ranch, some of them, when they went to reapply for a loan, were not able to get a loan because, as the mortgage company pointed out, your house sits in violation of your CCNRs. We don't need to take away, by your legislative ability, our rights if we don't govern ourselves appropriately by the number of votes that are there. We can live within the confines of those CCNRs. We don't want, being for myself and another 80 people on our ranch, we don't want you to decrease our ability to maintain our property. Summary of what I had to say.
Question?
I'd be glad to answer.
thank you. And you, if you want to, you could give your testimony to our community administrator, and we can have that testimony copied and delivered to the offices of the folks who are present.
I'll do that.
Tom, is in decreasing the percentage from 75 to 67%, you think that's too low of a threshold?
I guess I think that there are some things that you can change. And I've just gotten a hold of 2792. I didn't know it was in existence. And I wish you had shared that with me on Saturday, because I just talked to the lady a little bit. I've just read through here a little bit. There are some wonderful changes that are happening in here about the direction the board can go to make the place more orderly. But when you start talking about changing the aspects of the principal thing, the kind of houses you can put on, the square footage of the houses you can put on, the placement of your utilities, the type of utilities, all the major things that I think a buyer has a right to rely upon, just as he had in any other kind of a deed restriction. When you make it easy for that to change, I think you're usurping powers that you have given to us at the time of purchase. And if you want to do that for somebody who's new in a new subdivision, I don't personally care. But I relied upon those CC&Rs when I bought there. I relied upon the level of votes that would take. And I think that if you have an issue, and we have this issue about cutting down those trees, we are going to prevail, I think, and we will get that vote that's required, so that won't happen again. But when you change it, I think you take away some of our rights that were given to us at time of purchase.
So in your particular example, the board hasn't even followed the rules and law that you have.
Correct. And so if you make it easier for these rascals, and that's what I'll term them in a nice phraseology, to do these things on their own, what are they going to do when you decrease the voting requirements? It's a little scary, I think. I was the chairman out there in 1998, and we tried to get an amendment put in there that would clarify the number of votes required to change our CC&Rs, because our legal counsel said it is very dubious about whether you can even change or not. Frieda Garrett, who spoke to you about this bill, was the leader of the campaign against that. Now, we got 6-1 in favor of that bill. We needed 170 votes or something like that, and we ended up with 160. So we just barely lost. But I'd rather lose than have something go through there that takes away the values of the property.
Any other questions? Representative Berkeley and then Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. CC&R, for those of us not familiar, is that covenant and deed restrictions? What's the C?
Covenants and restrictions, yes.
Covenants and restrictions.
It's a little bit of a, I don't find that term necessarily in Section 94, but that's what they're called in our situation.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
I think it's covenant codes and restrictions.
Covenant codes and restrictions.
A couple of
conditions.
Covenant conditions and restrictions.
There we go.
A couple other clarifications, Mr. Chair. You spoke of amending the deed restrictions. This legislation, 2482, talks about the declaration that controls homeowners association. Are we talking about the same thing?
Well, we are, and it's a little bit convoluted. The CC&Rs speak to the fact of where, for instance, in this one instance that I brought up, you can place mobile homes within the subdivision, and it says you must refer to the deeded plat. So when you go to the deeded plat in Klamath County, it tells you which lots cannot have mobile homes and allowing mobile homes on all the rest of them. That was where the attorney says, yes, that is. Another attorney says, yes, it is not a deed restriction. So I'm going with the one that says it is a deed restriction.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I ended up with that clear. The assuming the section you're talking about is Section 1 of this legislation. Have you actually seen the legislation?
No, I have not actually seen the legislation.
I'll hold my questions then.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not privy to what Representative Merkley asked, but I wanted to ask Mr. Satterley about the logging that took place on the property. Was that done by virtue of a vote?
Of the Board of Directors.
The Board of Directors. But not...
The homeowners, when they met in August of 2000... said, do not cut our trees. Mm-hmm. That was the vote. Mm-hmm. Now, the vote that occurred at that time was merely a vote of the people at the annual meeting, and they did not even have a majority of the membership or quorum available. So there was really no business that was legal at that time. The CC&Rs, again, and the Oregon State statutes say that to take and remove anything from that property, which is common property, requires proper notification and proper voting of 75% of those people eligible to vote before it can be done. So on their own initiative, they tell to vote in December of 2000 and cut the trees down in 27th of December, I guess, when nobody was around.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate
Thank
the
you.
Fact that you came over.
I appreciate you having this. Thank you.
Barbara Cans and David, is it Bennett?
No, I'm good. Checking up and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Cans. I'm here with several hats on, one of which is a member of a group that I want to give you a little bit background on because we're here for all three bills, and it's kind of confusing. It's a ad hoc group, and I'm going to give you just briefly background of the condominium law, which was first enacted in 1963. At that time, it wasn't regulated by any agency. In 1969, it was put under the subdivision control law, which was administered by the real estate agency, and then in 1973, the Condominium Act was again amended, so the real estate agency had responsibility for approving the declaration and bylaws and everything else related to the filing. There were no significant changes to the law other than that until prior to the 1977 legislative session when the Oregon Association of Realtors, contemplating and anticipating that there would be conversion condominium issues, formed a study group, and they proposed amendments to the 77 legislative session and made some significant changes and as to substance and process. Since that time, I've coordinated a group that is the core of that group is since then have continued to meet and make changes to the condominium law as well. At the time, I was with the real estate agency responsible for reviewing and approving the condominium documents. That core of that group also was involved in proposing the Oregon Planned Community Act, which took effect on July 1 of 1982. And the group proposed amendments, significant amendments to that bill last session. The Planned Community Act is not administered by the real estate agency. There is no administrative oversight on it. It has to do with subdivisions that have a certain pattern of ownership, associations, rights, and owners. David will talk just a few minutes about the membership of the committee because it relates to the experience, but I do want to comment on the specific bill because that's what I'm supposed to be talking about. I've had some, our office has had some communication with Dr. Wedham, whose name is on the bill as a requester. And our concern was that this bill, as amended, it amends the Oregon Planned Community Act, Chapter 94. It doesn't really affect that project because it was in existence long before the Planned Community Act came into effect. So it's a question of the bill as it now reads wouldn't affect their project. There was also a concern that we understood with respect to how amendments are effected, and we had proposed amendment in another bill that you will be seeing eventually. Hopefully, it got dropped yesterday, that is trying to address that one particular problem and some other problems, but just as far as that 2482, as it is drafted, it would have to be significantly amended to deal with the particular project.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Bennett. I'm a partner in the law firm at Landy Bennett Blumstein in Portland. I graduated from Willamette Law School, took my last exam on May 3rd of 1971, went to the firm that hired me, walked in the door, and the partner said, "Here, kid, do this condominium." I had never heard of a condominium. I had no idea what that meant. That was the first piece of legal work I ever did. I've drafted documents for more than 400 projects since then. Our office represents more than 300 associations. I was editor of the State Bar CLE on the Regulation Taxation of Real Estate, co-author of the three chapters on condominiums, planned communities, and owners associations.
I regularly represent individuals who have disputes with other individuals and homeowners associations, who have disputes with the developer, who have disagreements with the association or the board of directors. So our office is representing the developers in developing projects, representing the association and their operations, representing the associations and men with their documents, representing individuals who are unhappy with certain aspects of the association's operations. Obviously, we don't represent all of them in the same project. I frequently speak locally and nationally on these subjects. I've been a member of the what Barbara calls the condominium working group since 1973 when it first formed. We had title people, lawyers, the real estate commissioner at the time was on that committee, and then realtors and others looking at amending the Condominium Act. In 1981 legislative session, Betty Niven, who was then chair of the State Housing Council, Community Associations Institute, which is a national organization made up of developers, homeowners, boards of directors, managers, lawyers, lenders, and others, is in Alexandria, Virginia. The national president was in Eugene at the time, so he was on the committee that came up with the new Planned Community Act. The, prior to that, when you have a planned unit development or PUD or a planned community, it is a, it's not made from the statute. It's a common law kind of thing. And the gentleman who spoke earlier, I believe, is in a project where the Planned Community Act does not apply. So the amendments that, that he is supporting wouldn't apply to his project in any event. I'm the only lawyer in Portland who's a member of the College of Community Association Lawyers, the national group promoted by CAI. And I've represented Washington County, the City of Portland, and Multnomah County on public service condominiums. And I say that when I, Barbara named this the Condominium Working Group, I always call it SASE, which stands for Self-Appointed Self-Important Group, and I think in some respects that's how we are. I go over sort of my relevant experience, and I have some copies of that if you want to see it. I think the chairman was given one by the State Bar Representative Bob Olson earlier, only to say that that's pretty much the relevant experience of all of us on the committee. Also on the committee is Gene Grant, who's a partner with Schwabe Williams and Wyatt, happens to be the mayor of Happy Valley, where I'll be tonight, in a land use matter. Barbara Kahns, who was with Bial Farthingham, a law firm in Portland, and for 10 years she was the condominium review officer, and I had to please her when I sent the projects that I was drafting down to her. Linda Triplett, who's tried to retire from a law firm in Portland and lives in Baker City but can't quite get it done. Rich Bial, Bial Farthingham, has done that. Chris Crane, who's now with Miller Nash but was legislative counsel for years, and the bills that we've brought down and rewrote those. Brian DeMarco from the real estate agency, who is currently the review officer I have to please now that Barbara's out of there. Rich Fernandez, who was a lawyer in Portland and gone with U.S. Affordable Housing. Howard Fierstein, who was on that original committee with me at Stoll Reeves. And John Gibbon, a lawyer, single practice, but worked for one of the largest developers in town and sort of learned from there as to how to do this. I simply say that is because we have come for this legislative legislature for many, many years, a group that's very diverse. We have accountants, we have property managers, we have other consultants, developers, legislators, regulators on this committee. Unfortunately, we're not very well known, so the last witness before Barbara and other people probably don't know about our committee that come in and say, here is something that is bothering me. I have to tell you, when people come, when I come and I have a particular problem and I say, well, I experienced this and I'm proposing that we suggest legislation amendments in this way because it solves this problem, and people put me to the test and say, does anybody else have that problem? Have you ever seen that problem before? And have you ever had that problem, Bennett, before? Well, not really, but it's a problem here. And my point is that there shouldn't be a legislative fix for everything. You know, we try to come and get make suggestions so that these things operate better. The boards of directors, the association, really is made up of the people who live there. You can't have, if everything that this legislature did had to go out with referendum, you'd never get anything done. We elect you so that you can make laws to regulate us. And in the same sense, an association elects a board of directors or board of trustees to help manage the affairs, and they can be recalled, they can be voted out, and so forth. So while I come from a broad experience in representing a lot of people, I understand the frustration. I get calls, I deal all day long with individual owners who have problems, and we try to resolve them with boards of directors that have problems with owners. Now, I want to just talk about this particular bill. and we'll come back later and talk about the other bill when that gets up. With respect to 67%, I can tell you how frustrating it is when I want to amend the documents for a planned community where they have a provision that says 90%, it takes 100% for 25 years and then 90% for after that. And it's very difficult. You just virtually can't amend anything. So you have the tyranny of the minority. And, you know, that's the kind of position I think this gentleman finds himself in, is he would like a lesser threshold. On the other hand, people buy into the community. One of his principal complaints is that there are mobile homes there. Well, the mobile homes apparently violate it. That somebody should bring a lawsuit to keep the mobile homes out of there. I mean, that is, we don't come to the legislature to say somebody violated the law, and I want you to enforce a law. That is uniquely something that judges do. And it can be very frustrating. We have difficult people to deal with. But I think there needs to be this 75% threshold. When people buy in to a community, and it's a deed restriction, all of us live in the developments where there are covenants, conditions, and restrictions. You can't have pigs and sheep, or you know, you can't have a fence farther to the front line than the front of your house. All of these kinds of things, we wouldn't like it very much if the neighbors could get together and a low threshold make amendments that change how we live and what the restrictions are against our property. And Representative Merkley, with respect to your question, covenants, conditions, and restrictions, it's, you know, the Declaration of Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions sets out how people are going to live there and how they're going to operate. Sometimes there's an association, sometimes there isn't. You know, what they can build on there or not, how they park, and it can be very loose to very tight. So I really don't think it ought to go to 67%. The other thing with respect to the quorum requirements, which is the other part of the bill, I used to have in the documents I drafted a 50% quorum. Then something needed to get done. People cared so little that nobody would come out and vote on it, so you couldn't make anything happen. For example, let's say you have a condominium or a master associate or a homeowners association where the roofs have to be repaired by the association. The budget or the special assessment has to be approved by the owners. So, and it's going to take a majority vote, and you have a 50% quorum. People won't come out to vote. The roofs are leaking and falling in. The board of directors, who is obliged to fix the roofs, has no money to fix the roof, and they can't get the people out to vote on it. So in my documents, what I generally say is the quorum is 40%, except if you don't have a quorum at a particular meeting, you may adjourn that meeting, and the quorum it falls to 25%. You know, that's what we picked in the Planned Community Act was at a threshold. It can be something different. I just point out to you that it is a problem when you're trying to get something done, but it's a very high threshold for a quorum. It's not that you can't, you know, stir people up and get them and vote. It's not that you can't change your mind and vote something different than what you voted for before. The biggest problem is you don't have enough people who are interested to come out and make a decision for the people who are interested to protect their property. I'm sorry if that's a little lengthy explanation.
That's fine. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. My reading of this bill actually is that you only need a 20% quorum in a situation like you were describing to get the roofs fixed. It simply says that there should be a 50% quorum for amending the declaration or the bylaws, which is quite a different type of topic. And it notes that that 50% quorum can include people present by proxy. Does that address your concerns?
Well, frankly, I hadn't seen the bill that came down here because I was looking at this other bill, and my understanding was that the quorum requirement was reduced to 50. It doesn't make any sense if that's what the bill is, because if it takes 67% or 75% of the total voting authority to change a declaration, how could you have a quorum of 50% still have 60% of the total voting authority? It doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't work.
Mr. Chair, a question to the chair.
Yeah.
Are we going to have a proponent of this bill to discuss?
This may be one of those bills that we don't.
Okay.
I had the bill drafted at the request of the folks who are on here, and I know there have been discussions with some of the other people who are in the room today, and so we thought we'd bring all the bills at the same time. And apparently, as Ms. Collins has suggested, there's another bill coming that the condominium working group has worked on, and as soon as we find out what that is and if it comes to this committee, we'll deal with that bill as well in light of these other bills.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for these witnesses on this particular bill? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2482? Seeing and hearing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2482 and move on to House Bill 2743. 92. Colleagues, as you might guess, the portion of the law that we're dealing with on these is pretty complicated and quite lengthy. This bill is probably one of the longest bills besides the workers' comp bill that you may see this session in this committee. And I think it's going to take a while to wade through some of these issues that are rather complicated, so we'll likely have more than one hearing on this bill. And it seems like my area of the state tended to have more problems and more interest than most, so I had several constituents contact me in regards to consumer protection on these particular issues, and we felt like it was this probably was the right committee to hear them in. And today I have a constituent actually that's here, as well as Tom Satterley, who spoke on the first bill, and her name is Harriet Heisey, and we'll have Harriet come with Brad. Is it Avakian or Avakian?
Avakian.
Avakian. I've always wanted to know. I've heard it both ways. Thank you both for coming, and please tell us who you are and proceed.
My name is Harriet Heisey, 60733 Breckenridge Street in Bend, Oregon. Good afternoon, Chairman Canope and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about the proposed legislation in HB 2792 regarding organized community statutes. In the booklet previously provided each of you, I summarized HB 2792 and the improvements I hope to attain. Included in there were media articles, industry comments, and case histories, which were there to give you a brief insight into what is happening nationwide, so that those who I have not met will understand what brings me here. I will briefly tell you how I became involved. In 1998, we purchased a home in a planned community of four separate villages. We read the governing documents and spoke with the president of the association, and he told us the four villages may become one association, but nothing else would change. 60 days later, proposed consolidation documents were presented, and everything had changed. One rule stood out above all others. That rule said, no person may solicit others within the community to offer, promote, or offer support for any item or proposal by means of personal contact, except with prior approval of the association. That an organization could write and enforce such a rule was unthinkable. Our First Amendment rights had been written away by a committee of people I had never heard of. Here was power beyond the U.S. government. So I set out to educate myself regarding HOAs. Then in 1999, the Oregon State Legislature enacted SB 1206, revising common interest development statutes, and additional changes affected my property rights. The governing documents we bought are not what we are living under today. And I believe that Oregon's 1999 legislation marked a shift of power from the homeowner to the association board of directors, giving them power that could pose serious problems for homeowners in the future, one of which is disclosure. When you listen to the state archive testimony given to the Senate Judiciary Committee on April 22, 1999, you will hear that one reason for the requested change of SB 1206 was because, quote, old bill had a lot more consumer protection aspect, a lot more protection for consumers in the disclosures. Now, the old disclosures required a statement by the declarant and a current status of the association statement. These statements were prepared by the declarant or the association after the turnover. Several of the questions then asked were, are there any capital expenditures anticipated within the next 2 years that may require special assessments? Now, they are only asked if the seller is aware of any special assessments. The seller may not be aware of any special assessments, but the board would. The old disclosures asked if the association is a party to any pending lawsuits or judgments, and if so, please explain. Nothing is in the new seller disclosure statements regarding pending lawsuits or judgments. The old statutes also ask the status of the common property. Has it been deeded over? The seller may not know this, but certainly the board would. So I believe that the current seller disclosure forms are not adequate, and in HB 2792, I ask that the old disclosure forms be reinstated. The budget. In the old budget provisions, the homeowners had the option, if 20% could get together, to petition the board for a meeting to discuss the budget and then vote to ratify or reject. This has been lost in the new 1999 legislation. It only requires that the board give a summary of the budget to the homeowners. There is no provision in there for them to request a meeting to debate or vote to ratify or reject the budget. The homeowner has been left out of the budgeting process. In ORS 94704 assessments, there is one sentence that was added that says, an owner may not claim to offset an assessment for failure of the association to perform the association's obligations. Offsetting such an assessment will, of course, result in lien and foreclosure of the home. Therefore, it's critical that the homeowners have the tools to remove a board if they are not fulfilling their obligations. ORS 94647, I believe, lacks directives in how to handle mail-in voting requirements. We need to consider Oregon's vote-by-mail procedures and then consider what is in this bill. In ORS 94647, there is no provision for a secret ballot or double envelopes as used by the state. There is no directives for safeguarding the confidentiality of the ballot. There is no provision for counting of the ballots by impartial persons. It does not prohibit opening the ballots before the final return date and actually specifies that the ballots may be counted from time to time as they come in. The possibilities for manipulation and fraud, I believe, are unlimited. Strict vote-by-mail laws must be mandated and written into the statutes. We just heard this gentleman from Central Oregon talk about how his board simply moved forward and did things without votes of the people and how they want to get rid of them. Well, without some provision in there to control how the ballots are handled in a write-in vote, I do not believe that there will be, if you really have reasonable and incompetent people, you cannot get rid of them. We need to have in place a voting procedure that will allow us to replace incompetent and an unreasonable board. We need to have some control over how the vote, mail-in vote, is handled. The Oregon Statute 94709 has the power to lien and foreclose and gives that power to the board. In addition to foreclose for regular or special assessments, attorney's fees, late charges, fines, and interest are enforceable as assessments and therefore subjects the home to foreclosure. A homeowner charged with a violation and disputing the charge may soon find costs spiraling out of control. And if you've read some of the case histories in the little booklet, you can see how quickly this can happen. That's why I have requested in HB 2792 that fees, late charges, fines, and interest be separately defined and not enforceable as assessments. Foreclosure may be by non-judicial, in which the homeowner does not get his day in court and may not request his day in court. I have not even addressed that issue. What I am asking for is for the requirement of a dispute resolution before any fine can be levied. The homeowner must have an opportunity to plead his or her case before a panel of impartial persons. As it is now, the board is the accuser, the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury. There is no burden of proof assigned to the association. I believe that the current common interest development laws are hardline policies of assessing, fine, enforce, lien, and foreclose. How well does this serve Oregonians living in such communities? Have we created communities where people have their rights and liberties respected? Has the state provided organized channels for the redress of grievances outside the costly courtroom? No state agency or department will take a complaint against an HOA. So we have no track records available to us to know how deep or how broad the problems may be. Are there checks and balances of government and a system of justice that will hold a board of directors accountable for their actions? Only state legislation can bring these things about. So that is what brings me to this date and time in HB 2792. All I started out to do was buy a house. Thank you for your time and consideration today, and a special thanks to Chairman Tenote, as he has listened to me for almost a year. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you, Harriet. I know you've done a lot of research just on your own situation and traveled to several states to find out about what they're doing. And some of these documents that you've given us are kind of interesting. I would draw the committee's attention to, you guys have the same thing that I have here, but there's the What's Your Fine page, and then it goes to what the fine actually is. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as it relates to the homeowners association that you're in?
Okay. What that is I did the What's Your Fine page. The fine schedule, as it's called, was proposed by our homeowners association last summer. It will tell you in there that the fines will range from $50 to $2,500 or more there will be a special fine that can be or more for a flagrant violation. What it does not tell you is, what is a $50 fine? What is a $2,500 fine? What constitutes a flagrant violation? We do have lists of rules and regulations. You cannot leave your car in the driveway. You may not cut down a tree. You cannot paint your home a different color. You have all these rules and regulations, but not one rule or regulation is linked to a specific fine. And I feel that is absolutely uncalled for. They know what the rules and regulations are, and they should know what they want to fine you for them. When I went before the board and questioned this and pointed out that a person could be fined probably for something they didn't even know was a rule, they can make them up as they go along, and they do. You have to have some kind of a guideline as to what the fine is going to be. So I said to the board, I said, if I leave my car in the driveway for a month, what is my fine? And the chair lady looked around the board and no one answered. And she said, oh, $250. And I said, see? I said, you made it up right while you were sitting there. That alone is a minefield for the homeowner. I was able to get several other homeowners to protest it with me, and it has not been enacted. It's still out there in the proposal stage, but it has not been enacted.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may, before we finish.
Sure.
Brad Avakian from Portland. Ms. Heisey has talked about her specific situation, which is, of course, important in her development of how she's come to this point. But as you get into your work session and you look more specifically at the amendments she's proposing, I think you'll see that they don't relate to her situation specifically, but they're broader than that in a consumer protection sense. The choice that she's bringing to you now is whether to continue to protect those that are in positions of power on these associations, and those who used to have power but don't after the latest revisions to this statute. Mr. Bennett gave you an example of how when you have people in positions of power like yourselves, that the proper democratic process is to simply vote them off if they don't do what you think that they should do. But I want to give you a different analogy, because I don't think that analogy fits the reality of this particular statute. If you were to view your own conduct in passing laws in this fashion, able to, without even coming to a meeting such as this, to send in a vote by mail that was not even verifiable as having come from you, that could impose a sanction on an individual that eventually could lead to the foreclosure of property without even going through the judicial process. That's what the current statute and the revisions that were made last session enable homeowners associations to do in Oregon. So the amendments that are before you now are not simply to take care of a particular problem in one association or another around the state, but are really procedural and policy type of revisions that give a balance of power back to homeowners. The difficulty with thinking that if your homeowners association doesn't do right by you, you can just vote them out next time, is that this current statute has already enabled irreversible harm to be done before you get to that point. Ms. Heisey's amendments allow the procedure to be fair before you get to the democratic process of voting people on or off a board. And lastly, the state of Nevada struggled with the same issues that are before you now and were before you at the last session, and adopted many of the amendments that are similar to what Ms. Heisey is presenting to you now. We have a videotape that was made by the Nevada legislature to you, explaining the purpose behind their revisions and the importance of addressing them in this state, that we would certainly make available to any one of you that would like to have it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for our two witnesses? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Heisey, I really appreciate all the work that you've done, but I have to tell you, it's always embarrassing to admit what I'm going to admit right now, which is that I obviously voted on this legislation last session, but don't remember it being controversial, because it obviously was extensive. So do you know, having looked, I know you weren't probably involved in the process, but having looked through the record, was there a lot of testimony in opposition to this when it came before us?
Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, I listened to the archive testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee and the House Judiciary Committee. And it was brought by the people that are behind me, calling themselves the Condominium Working Group. And I called the state offices here and got a list of who those people were. Now, in that testimony, one page of it there is given to you. They did their hearing on the 22nd of April. They did one on the 4th of May, and it passed without a single no vote in either the House Judiciary or the Senate Judiciary Committee, and passed the full legislature without a single no vote. It received a due pass recommendation out of both judiciary committees. And when I first talked with Chair Canope about it, I asked him to please provide me with the names of any legislator that had voted no. A week later, he called me back and he said, no one voted no.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I guess, that's a partial answer. I was also, though, trying to get at, because it does sound like you're raising some pretty significant consumer protection issues, and there's not always an organized group to come forward and point those out to us at the time we're considering something. It doesn't appear that anybody did raise these issues.
There was last session. No, they did not. Representative Larry Wells asked the question of one of the gentlemen that was presenting if any homeowners had been asked about this. And the answer that he got back, as I recall, was that he represents 250 homeowners associations and that lawyers, developers, and accountants had been quizzed. There was not a direct, as I recall, yes or no answer. Yes, the homeowners were included, and no, they were not. But there was no other people that testified except for the condominium working group.
And a final question, Mr. Chair. I guess this would be either Ms. Heisey or Mr. if I can. It's sounding almost like a tyranny by these boards of directors. I mean, I realize you're complaining about statutes that don't appear to be very balanced to you, but also the boards themselves are presumably elected by the people that live in these communities. So, I mean, I'm appreciative that it's not a fair answer to just say wait and vote them out, because, you know, we try to say that about ourselves. But wouldn't it be the case that if somebody had a lot of problems with the way these boards were operating, they would be able to run for the board and start to, I mean, you would think there would be a voice of dissent within these communities from some of the active homeowners such as yourself.
Mr. Chair and the Representative Rosenbaum, I do think you're right about that, and I think that is a fair way to address a lot of these issues. Also, neither of us are saying that all homeowners associations are bad. As a matter of fact, there could be great benefits to organizing communities through associations. The only thing we're looking for here is to have a fair process established in the statute itself. Once that happens, then if there are difficulties that arise, by all means, you know, running for the office and fighting for change from within is exactly what should happen. The current statutes don't reflect a fair process.
Thank you.
Any other questions for two witnesses?
Representative
Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to Representative Rosenbaum. Because when Ms. Heisey was in my office, I asked her the same question. I served on the Judiciary Committee last session. I have no independent recollection of this bill at all. And generally, I'm a pretty strong consumer advocate, so I think that the presentation must have been that this bill was agreed to. And, of course, I don't have my bill file on this one anymore. I saved one drawer full of bill files. But this one got tossed, so I have no idea what went on, but Ms. Heisey has transcribed some of what happened.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Murphy, you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have attached to your package, is it pronounced Heisey?
Heisey,
Mrs. Heisey. The seller's property disclosure statement. And this is the current statement, is that correct?
That is correct. I got that from a real estate office in Bend, and that is what they gave me. Okay.
And Mrs. Heisey, you mentioned to me in the office that this was insufficient in a number of key ways affected by the legislation we passed in 99.
Yes.
I think it would be useful to have you hit the three or four key points on that again as to how this should be fixed.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Rosenknopf. What I wanted to do in this was to make the statement that just to provide the codes, covenants, and restrictions and to answer a statement whether or not there were any special assessments outstanding was not sufficient. The old disclosure forms were much more detailed. The declarant had to fill out a form that told the build-out of the community, the number of lots, the number of units, so on and so forth. He had to prepare that. Then the association prepared a statement of the current status of the association, which told about if there were any liens against that particular property and mentioned capital expenditures anticipated within the next 2 years that may require a special assessment. This is important because if you have a homeowner buying a home and they are maybe just barely getting in there dollar-wise, and all of a sudden, a year later, the association says, we have to repave the streets, we have to put new roofs on the condominiums, we have to do all of these major capital expenditures, and your assessment is going to be $5,000. Maybe they can't come up with it. Maybe this is something that their budget will not handle. If a provision is in the disclosure that a certain amount of money is anticipated for capital expenditures within the next 2 years, this gives a prospective buyer at least some kind of an idea of what they may be looking at budget-wise for themselves. Simply by letting it be said on that current disclosure form that all they have to answer is the seller aware of any pending special assessments, in my estimation, is not sufficient. The seller, unless they're on the board, may not know about what the board is planning to do in the way of capital repair. So the seller can say, no, I'm not aware of anything, and be perfectly honest in his answer or her answer. But then the capital expenditure occurs. So that is why I am saying to reinstate the old disclosures. That's one of the reasons, is that I believe it is a protection for a prospective buyer.
Thank you very much.
Is that it?
Thank you.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me a little background on why folks move into developments, the type that this legislation addresses? Is so far different from buying a single standalone piece of property, it seems. And so can you tell us a bit about why these and what is the interest by people to live in them?
Well, a lot of times I think people aren't even aware that they've bought into one. They get the codes, covenants, and restrictions, and they get the bylaws and maybe the rules and regulations, and they don't read them. It's a concept of housing that is really very much misunderstood, I believe. A lot of times people buy into them because they like the amenities. There's tennis courts, swimming pools, biking trails, all sorts of amenities that go along with this particular house, things that they couldn't afford maybe on their own in a single family house. So they see this development, they're in the market for a home, and they go in and they buy it, because they're dazzled by a lot of what they see. And then they get in there and they don't understand what they've bought. They want to do something with this house, or they want to live like they did before with the garage door up and the garbage can out for 2 days, and they find out they can't do that because there are rules and regulations that say that the aesthetics of the community need to be maintained. And so a lot of people get into, you know, difficulties because they're simply ignorant of what is expected of them, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, I was asked once to describe what a homeowners association or how common interest development is in just a few words. And I thought about it, and the best thing that I could come up with was it's a utopian concept implemented by unrestrained authoritarian policies. And that just
Should I follow up to that, Representative
Wilson? You asked.
I'm taking a different trail. To explore a little further the idea about one buying in and not really understanding what they're buying into, I have to ask, if that is the case, who typically does one purchase a unit in one of these developments from? A realtor, or is it an on-site type broker, or whom?
Well, it can be either way. I mean, if the development is not entirely built out, the declarant or the developer is still selling units, so there'd be a model house or whatever, and he probably has a real estate company, or maybe it's his own real estate company, handling the sale of the property. In the particular instance, the planned community that I bought into, we bought from the owner. It's a community that's about 12 years old, and so the developer is out of the picture now. He wasn't at the time we bought it, but he is now, and so we bought from a resident who was selling their home.
Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Representative Wilson, if I may add to that, these planned communities oftentimes, as Ms. Heisey said, have recreational facilities that are close to home, meeting rooms that are close to home, planned activities within the community, and oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the single family homes are less expensive than you might find in existing other neighborhoods. It's a very attractive type of community for seniors, for some disabled folks, certainly not exclusively, but you'll see higher numbers of seniors in these types of neighborhoods, and so you're dealing sometimes with population of individuals that are more vulnerable financially than you'll see in single-family dwellings in standard neighborhoods, which makes it even, because they want to live in a community that's got those types of activities and other resources close at hand. It's because of that that the fair process that we're asking you to look at is even more critical than it otherwise would be.
Representative?
Just one brief follow-up to that. Is one of the attractions then to a certain level of security with the resident believing that he or she may know generally what to expect from that community as far as lifestyle? I know a lot of times when you buy into a neighborhood, you know, you have no control over what the neighbors do and so on and so forth. So is the security aspect, knowing what tomorrow is going to bring, to some extent, what residents want when they purchase in a development like this?
Now, taking, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, taking the example that I used of a senior couple that wants to retire, they go to a planned community so they can have those resources close at hand, oftentimes on a fixed income, oftentimes believing that that's where they're going to spend the rest of their lives. And so, yes, you're looking, you're not generally looking at, you know, 35-year-old folks buying their first houses and raising kids where they will have lots of changes over the course of their life. Oftentimes you're looking at folks on fixed incomes that are hoping to spend the remainder of their lives in a particular place. When that's the case, especially on a fixed income, you don't always have the option when things don't go right of selling and moving somewhere else. You're stuck with what you got. And when you're in that position in a process that doesn't afford you the kind of power to make the changes that need to be made before you're already harmed, as we've described, then folks are trapped. And as I said before, we would hope, we don't think every homeowners association does that. But the process allows for it to happen. And because the process allows for it to happen, the process needs to be changed to protect folks, all folks in those communities, but especially those like the seniors that I've described.
Thank you, Paul.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Question about page 35 in your bill. You have in here a couple of standard forms, notices, and one of them, the one on page 35, deals with a right of rescission or a right of cancellation. It is a five-day right of cancellation. Does that five-day right of cancellation exist currently?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is in that, on those forms that I gave you, sir. It says in there there's a five-day. You have a five-day right.
Okay. On the, is that on the current current form or the form that you would like to see?
It's on the current. It's on the current form on page 3, where it says the second line: you, the buyer, have 5 business days from the seller's delivery of the seller's disclosure statement to revoke your offer. It is still currently in there. on page 3.
The last page of the form?
Uh-huh. Just above here, right here.
Okay. So
it says buyer's acknowledgement, and then in the bold type.
Yes. Okay. Yes, you, the buyer, have 5 business days. The in what you have proposed in your bill, that appears to be brought out much more boldly. Was that your intention? Were you afraid this was getting lost, that people had this right of rescission?
I believe in the bill, I simply said to bring back the ones that were repealed, to bring back the statutes that had been repealed by SB 1206, the disclosure statute.
Maybe we're talking about the same thing. Excuse me, just one moment, Mr. Chair. But it looks like on page 35 of your bill, if you have that, that there is a much bolder notice of your right of cancellation.
Oh, yes, I
that's what you intended. You were concerned that was getting lost, that people weren't aware of their 5 days.
That's true, yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Barbara Kahns and David Bend again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barbara is the client to come back up here. Let me say, first of all, this, that you didn't decline after all? Okay. I don't think our committee has a monopoly on good ideas. The ideas that we have and suggest the legislature over the years have come from people just like the last witness. Sometimes I remember coming down here years ago, and the chair of that particular committee had a problem with his homeowners association and amended our bill, and other than that, no one said anything. And as Representative Rosenbaum indicated last time we come down here, you folks can't know everything about everything, and this is a very complicated area of the law, believe me. The concern I have is that we would enact a bill which affects all associations in Oregon, all of them subject to the Planned Community Act, because of the anecdotal experiences of one or two associations. There are, I have no idea how many condominiums there are. There are probably 2,000 plus. I mean, I've done 400 or so myself, so I know there's a lot of condominiums in Oregon. Planned communities, planned unit developments, are common law creatures, and they have existed for many, many, many years. So you have associations such as Sun River, Black Butte, Broken Top, Mountain Park, King City Civic Association, Forest Heights Homeowners Association, Summerfield Association. Some of those are senior associations. We either currently represent all of them or have represented most of them in the past. I think we represent all of them now except for Mountain Park Homeowners Association. And her boss represents the rest of them. We represent a lot of condominium associations as well. Some of the things that they testified about, they were quite innocently quite wrong about. One is there is no non-judicial foreclosure proceeding to foreclose liens in homeowners association. You can only foreclose it judicially. We represent 300 plus homeowners association. My partner, Karna Gustafson, has done for 6 years collections. We have a paralegal working with her now. We probably write 50 letters a week to homeowners associations who are delinquent, maybe half that many, I don't know, biblically speaking. My dad was a Baptist preacher, so we always kind of got bigger and bigger as we went along. So, but in any event, we file probably 15 or 20 liens a week against homeowners, individual homeowners who haven't paid their assessments. We've been doing this for many, many years. I believe we have actually gone to foreclosure on about 10. First of all, your lien is inferior in both planned community, planned unit developments, and condominiums to the lien of the first mortgage. So virtually, there's a couple of times when somebody doesn't have any first mortgage that we would foreclose. So foreclosure is really never an option. With respect to fines, and her suggestion is that we have fines of $50 to $2,500, and we don't know which, and the chairman would say, well, I think that fine is this. I think that's absolutely unenforceable. I mean, I think a remedy is in a court of law. If I represent her and somebody fined her $2,500, I would, you know, and if they put the lien on my lot, I would sue them for disparaging my title because I don't think there's no standard for doing it. So, I mean, I think that's one of the issues. But I represent the Sun River Owners Association. They went out there and fined a guy $37,000 for cutting some trees. And I went over and I said, we're not doing this. This is ridiculous. And, you know, we end up, the guy replanted some. I think he paid a $500 fine. So some of those things happen that aren't smart. There are bad boards of directors.
I just interject here a little bit. I understand that these may be rare instances. My concern, I guess, would be that when a homeowner goes into one of these communities, that they know up front maybe what the potential liabilities are going to be, and that maybe that this act or this law not be a full employment act for attorneys. Somebody has to go out and find an attorney just to defend themselves from someone who's overreached. So I guess my question would be, do you think that it can be defined better in statute? In other words, putting some sideboards on some of these homeowners associations and their ability to levy a fine?
Frankly, I've never been a big advocate of fining. I don't think fining cures the problems, and I tell people that. We fine, and we actually, our office doesn't allow them to fine or tells them not to fine very often because I don't think that's an effective remedy. Sometimes it is. But generally speaking, it isn't. If somebody's violating the covenants for whatever reason, we'll file suit for an injunction. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for mediation, for sitting down and having a general discussion with people. You know, we have boards of directors that are boneheads. And, I mean, they won't take our advice. You know, I gave a chairman advice just recently in a letter, and she said, you gave me more advice than I asked for. I said, perhaps so, madam, but not more than you needed. And I think, you know, I mean, that's what happens. And you have some bad boards. There's no question about it. We represent some of them that are bad boards. But I think that's, you know, one of the problems that we have here. I think you could, with respect to finding, I think that's one aspect of her suggestion that you probably could narrow a little bit and say you have to have some specific standards. First of all, you have to have a hearing. You can't fine without a hearing, without an opportunity for a hearing. The question is, in her proposal, if you have a neutral board of arbitrators, who's going to pay the cost of that? What is the cost of that? Do you just not fine? Maybe it'll be okay with me, say we're not going to fine. And I think, you know, what's going to happen is you can sue for injunctions if the association is convinced it's correct. They're going to get attorney's fees when they enforce it. As insofar as a full employment act for lawyers, it's been a full employment act for me for 30 years. If you adopted her bill in total and ignored the bill that we're coming, I'd still be fully employed because I'd have to be interpreting it and trying to figure out how it affected. I have no problem with the rights of an individual homeowner. They have rights. And you know, the individuals who are on the board are the same people. And, you know, if some board member is abusing their discretion, they ought to be sued. And we do sue them on behalf of individual owners. And, you know, I don't think that you can have a legislative fix for every anecdotal problem. I think that some of the things she talks about, I think that they may be very well some things that you guys want to consider putting in, combining the bills, what have you. But I think a lot of the stuff are things that come from her experience, a very bad experience, a very frustrating experience that I would not want to see imposed on, you know, the 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 homeowners associations in the state of Oregon. You are representing not just her, you're representing all these other people who aren't before you who seem to think that the statute works well as it is set up now. With respect to the disclosure things, when we put this in the law, you put it in the law, but we made the suggestion in 1981 legislature, and it was effective in 1982 for most planned unit developments, and then in 1984 for the balance of them. In that instance, where the average assessment did not exceed 2% of the average fair market value of the lots, so a lot of associations didn't cover. The Sun River, for example, wasn't covered. And when the Planning Community Act came in, Sun River would never exist today if we didn't make some modifications the last legislative session. You couldn't do that kind of a project. What we did last session was recommend that we eliminate this disclosure thing, the statement of declarant's interest and statement of homeowner association status, not so much concerned about the declarant, because the declarant, you know, is going to make that the information available and go on in any event in their sales agreement, or if they fail to disclose it, they're going to have liability for it. But because of the what you're looking at, I think, is Chapter 105, the Disclosure Disclaimer Act, that applies to all sales of residential real property that aren't exempt. A security is exempt if it is a security like a stock or bond or a rental pool or what have you. The condominiums are exempt because we have a disclosure statement which is filed with the real estate agency, and that is the public disclosure, the white paper. But for planned unit developments, the Chapter 105 applies, and so they have a 5-day rescission right if they give it. If they don't give it, have a disclaimer, it's a 7-day rescission right. And what we tried to do was put some more things in that last time that made disclosures with respect to homeowners association, and we're considering we want to do that this time. We didn't get around to it. There's probably some things in there that could be put in there. One of the problems you have is if you have the homeowners association status report, who's going to make it? The board of directors, the association. What if it's wrong? Who has liability? You know, the board of directors, the association. Almost all documents will indemnify the board of directors for good faith negligence. And so they don't know if there's a judgment. They got to go find out if there's a judgment, if somebody's going to file suit against them. They may be contemplating assessment but really haven't imposed it yet. What is it they're supposed to say? Somebody moves in and then there's assessment later on and they come back and say, well, I got this statement from the homeowners association and it's wrong and I want to sue the association. I mean, they're effectively suing themselves. So this is the balance that we go through when we're looking at it. If I'm going to buy in, I want to know as much as possible. I get a title report. In that title report, I get copies of all the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, any other things of record, and I can see as much as I might be able to with, you know, whatever degree of experience that I have. As a real estate lawyer, I'm going to be able to look at it and know what it says. Most people aren't. You know, if you folks aren't real estate lawyers, you may be lawyers but not real estate lawyers, you're looking at it, you know, you're going to say, what does this mean? And frankly, sometimes things that I've written over the years, I look at it and go, what does this mean? I mean, it's a complicated area of the law. So, but they have that. You have the right to ask, and both the Condo Act and the Planned Community Act requires the association to respond to an owner who's selling the property as to judgments and potential liens, what have you. So if you're going to go in and buy one of those things, you ought to make that inquiry. So the question is, where is the balance between an innocent owner coming in and saying, I'm buying in an association, I'm buying into Sun River, I'm buying in Broken Top, I'm buying into Lapine Acres and some of the more rural kinds of projects, where does that balance come from their protection versus the person who lives there that says, what should I disclose? What is my liability? What do I have to find out? Or the liability of the board of directors, who are unpaid people, to say, well, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't really know there was a judgment. And we talked about this assessment. You know, that's the kind of balancing test that you have to go through. And, you know, I don't know how to do that exactly. I don't know where it is. But I do think that people buying into them need to know more when they buy into them. And education is one of those principal things. I have a number of things I can talk about specifically with respect to things that she talked about. What I would, I guess, like to do is have a discussion with her and her lawyer about the kinds of things they're trying to accomplish, see how that dovetails into some other kinds of things. I would ask that they back away from a lot of the stuff that they're asking for and get a little bit, maybe, of what they're after. The things that particularly gore their ox that we can look at and say, we believe that is a fair thing for all associations. You have to balance, are lenders going to loan on it? Is a realtor going to sell it? Is the seller going to sell it? Is a buyer going to buy it? What are their protections? What about the board of directors, people who are unpaid people? You know, what kind of liability do they have? What about the association making a statement of, here's what the condition is, and it turns out to be wrong, and they have liability? All of those things are things that you folks have to balance. And I think, you know, I guess quite frankly, I think that we who work in the industry all the time with lenders, with developers, with associations, with managers, with regulators, and with a lot of individual homeowners who have problems, probably are in a better position to advise you as to what works best than anybody else. But as I said, you know, if somebody comes along with something I never heard of before that's a major problem, you know, we have to deal with that.
I appreciate, Mr. Bennett, your invitation to meet with Ms. Heisey and go over some of these issues, and I would encourage you to do that. As far as the condominium working group goes, who originally started that? Was that you, Barbara?
No. Well, she wasn't around yet. Were you? Said you were.
You're all
too young, huh?
For the record, Barbara Kahn, Chair Knopf. It was originally put together, a study group by the Association of Oregon Realtors, and I had a very broad group to look at the existing condominium law because it hadn't been looked at since it had been first enacted, and there were some significant changes. And you don't need to know what all they were, but they were very, this is consumer protection, first time, for instance, the on conversion condominiums, tenants' right to buy, and those kinds of issues were proposed by that particular group. And we, as administering the law, I saw lots of things that need fixing in the law, and we've tried to, as we've gone along, balance it.
But it's more than the Condo Act. We've taken on in 1982 and Betty
Time Share.
We've done the timeshare stuff, and Betty Niven wanted to do the Planned Community Act and put that as a creature statute, and that doesn't apply to all homeowners associations.
Sure. I did look over the names on your condominium working group, and I saw a lot of people there who probably represent associations or developers or and other folks. Is there anybody who specifically represents the consumer or individual homeowners?
Well, we all represent individual owners. I represent dozens of individual owners and suits against associations or issues against associations that I don't represent.
I understand, but I think it would benefit the working group if there was a Harriet Heisey that was on the board or involved with your working group to who's has an interest in this area. Just to say, you know, I understand where you're headed, but, you know, this is our experience or whatever, and kind of just to be a foil, so to speak, for you guys.
I have no problem. We've had an open group. We've had all kinds of people on and off of it. It's a lot of work, believe me, and she obviously has put a lot of work in and is deeply interested in it, and that's where stuff comes about, when people find out. She, you know, I mean, we're going to learn a lot from her. She'd learn a lot from us, and we don't have any objection to working with people, and as I said before, no one has an exclusive monopoly, I guess that's a pleonasm, but on good ideas.
Yeah,
well, I just want to say a couple other things. One, in the mail-in ballot, she talked about that, and the secret ballot. There is no association that I know that has secret ballot. I can remember I represented an association with Mark Hatfield, was living in there, and he stood up, puffed out his chest, and said, this secret ballot. I said, well, Senator, I'm sorry, but there is no secret ballot in this association. Well, we always vote by secret ballot. So you don't vote by secret ballot in the Senate. We all vote in our governmental bodies have a right to secret ballot. I've never seen an association, very few associations vote by secret ballot. Senator Verona's association votes by secret ballot. To the extent that she didn't like the way the written ballot was, I wrote that section, and I wrote it because some homeowners association had a difficult time amending documents, figuring out when they had 75% approval, if they had to have 75% approval to approve a budget, to amend a document, what have you, and you'd go out and the statute said that you had to tell a certain date when all the ballots had to be in, and then you counted them. So if you had a failure, didn't get 75% said yes or 25% that said no, you didn't get 75% said yes, you were done, so you had to start over. So in the interest of economy, we changed that so that you could actually count them from time to time. It never occurred to me that there was going to be a bunch of fraud involved. I've not seen that, but it's not to say that there wouldn't be somebody who would get in there and manipulate the ballots and figure out, you know, I don't have any problem with eliminating that. I don't care. I mean, we haven't used it very often, although I do put that on my written ballot that will count it from time to time because it saves a lot of time to say 26% voted no, we're done, 75% voted yes, we're done, and we can go forward. That's why I had drafted it that way, and we haven't seen a problem with it, but, you know, it's not to say there aren't.
Barbara, you have something else to add to that?
Be brief, Chair. Knopf, members of the committee. Just a couple general comments with respect to the characterization of last session of Senate Bill 1206. The main one of the main purposes last session, and we said so in our testimony and in our written documentation, was to parallel the condominium law and the Planning Committee Act as much as we could because they were different. And there was no intent to change any balance between the owners and the board, and if that's the case, I'm not aware of it. Not saying there isn't, but there was no intent. We'd work from a side-by-side trying to make the two statutes as similar as possible given the difference in form of ownership. Number two, I'd just like to say with respect to input from owners, David will recall Betty Niven. I don't know if any of you recall who Betty Niven is. She was one of the instigators of the housing division, and it was because of Betty Niven, and I would say I conspired with Betty that we have the Planned Community Act in the first place, and it was a consumer active person very much like lady back there who brought a lot of these and implemented them and was a driving force. So the working group of all people certainly appreciates owners and consumer active people, and we would welcome working with her. I just regret that she didn't contact us earlier and may have misunderstood our positions and our intent.
Well, I think part of the problem that we do see with the current way our legislature is structured is that many times those of us who are new to these committees and maybe new to the issues don't know that there are groups out there, and certainly our citizens many times don't know. So to the extent that we're aware of them, we try to get parties working together before bills come forward. So we appreciate that invitation. I'm going to see if we can't go to the next bill, and we've got a couple people who have come to testify on that. And is there – oh, you wanted to testify on this one? Okay. Karna, are you Karna?
Yes.
Okay. We have one more person on this bill, Karna Gustafson.
Uh-huh. I promise I'll take too much time. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karna Gustafson. I'm a partner with the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. I am also the 2001 chair of Community Association Institute, Oregon chapter. Let me tell you a little bit about Community Association Institute. It is a national organization of over 17,000 members, which include owners, board members, attorneys, accountants, bankers, all kinds of professionals in the association industry. Community Association Institute strives to educate homeowners, provide forum for networking, provide classes for them, board training workshops, all of that type of thing. We have 120 members in Oregon of the Oregon chapter of Community Association Institute. I did provide the the annual report for 1999 for Community Association Institute. I have 15 copies if you would like it. Also, what I believe Sarah is handing out to you are two letters. One is from Union Bank of California. The other one is from Community Management, Inc. Community Management, Inc. represents 76 homeowners associations, and Union Bank of California lends to these individual homeowners associations. Both are members of Community Association Institute, and both are on the board of directors for Community Association Institute and on the Legislative Action Committee. I'm here on behalf of CAI and the Legislative Action Committee, and I have quite a few concerns about this bill. I represent and I have been representing homeowners associations and owners for the last 6 years. That's all I've ever done. I represent, you know, some developers also, but I don't really do any other type of law. That's what I do. And I can tell you that many of these provisions in this bill paralyze an association's ability to govern their owners and to protect the assets of the association. One of the assets of the association is the income stream and the assessments that come in from these individual owners. If you start reducing the ability of these associations to collect their assessments by limiting the lien rights, things like that, I can tell you a lot of the associations we're going to find in bankruptcy, because the only way the association can pay their bills is if all the individuals pay their bills. They all have a budget. Say the budget's $100, you have 100 members, everybody pays their dollar. If you don't pay your dollar, then the association only has $99 and cannot pay their bills. That is a problem. I have some specific concerns that the proponent of this bill brought up. Again, I want to reiterate that there is no non-judicial foreclosure in Oregon. You have to foreclose only judicially. On the offset issue she brought up, the ability or the association owners cannot claim an offset for the association not carrying out their responsibilities. That is a codification of case law. There's case law all around the United States about that you cannot, it's basically you can't bring a counterclaim saying they didn't fix my deck. And the whole purpose behind that and what courts have said is you can't paralyze the ability of the association to collect its assessments for fixing the deck that it needs to fix. If they can't collect the assessments to fix the deck, they'll never get the deck fixed. So if you want to bring a separate action against the association, you can, to have your deck fixed, but you cannot offset your claim that your deck isn't fixed by failing to pay your assessments. So I wanted to address that issue. I think that many other states have even more aggressive rules than we do. I just got back from the Community Association Institute's law seminar down in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, and most states are represented there, and I will tell you that a lot of the states and a lot of the lawyers from the other states indicate that their laws are much more aggressive. They provide for non-judicial foreclosure of liens. They provide for super priority that jump over a first mortgage, which is extremely aggressive, as well as some other things. On the fining issue, with regard to not to eliminate the right of an association to file a lien for fines, I find that would really undermine the ability of the association to enforce its rules. They have to have ability to enforce their rules. One of the ways that they enforce their rules, short of going to court, which we're always trying to avoid people going to court, is to fine the owner and file a lien. If you don't have the right to file a lien, you're going to end up in court every single time. And I think that's unacceptable. I have lots of other things, but I know we're running out of time, so if you have any questions for me specifically, or if you would like copies of the Community Association Institute annual report, I'll be happy to give that to you.
Yeah, I think the committee clearly does not have enough paper. And I think we should distribute those for the committee members.
Okay.
So they have something from everyone who's come. And please leave your contact information, too, so
okay.
We can get in touch with you as well. I didn't see anything on here that maybe had your address or phone number, so we can
okay.
Get back in touch with you.
Not a problem.
Any questions for Ms. Gustafson? Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Gustafson, you didn't address the issue of stronger disclosures. And as I looked at the disclosures in the proposed bill, they certainly touch on many of the key things that I would want to know if I was moving into such an association. And probably they help pull out of things that would otherwise be hidden or not understood, embedded in the law or embedded deep in the documents I'm signing at closing. Do you have objections to having such stronger disclosures in place to help people understand the deal that they're about to enter into?
My understanding is the disclosures that are in there and that have been put back in there from the last legislative session, which were repealed last time, are from the developer or the declarant only, and they're not going to help an individual owner who purchases from a second owner, non-declarant, non-developer. So in as far as how much they're going to protect associations, I don't, or individual owners, they're not going to protect any of them past the individual developer, the transfer of ownership from the declarant. It sounds to me like the supporter of this bill moved into an association where it was still developer controlled. And when you are moving into an association where it's still developer controlled, the developer is on the board of directors and the developer. They added this. Oh. Well, current status of homeowner association, isn't that something that just the developer has to do?
No.
It's not?
The developer has to vote on the
assessment. Right. Okay, and that is just for the Planned Community Act, right? Not for the Oregon Condominium Act. And I don't have a problem with the associations providing disclosure. My concern is, again, the liability of the board of directors for improperly providing the information and gaining the information. So I do have that dilemma. And then if I think there is a proposal, and we have considered in our Legislative Action Committee a proposal on a resale certificate, which is something similar to the state of Washington. They have something like this, but it's provided by the individual homeowner or the, in some instances, the manager on resales, not just in the first instance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I would just invite you to read through these disclosures in detail, and if you would be willing to advise me of the pieces that you find objectionable and why, it could be very useful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Rosenbaum? Did you have a question?
I'll pass. Thank you.
You gonna pass?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill, which one were we on? 2792? Seeing no one else, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2792. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2793. And it looks like we have John. Is it John Blatt? John, we have about 17 minutes or so. And I've got two witnesses, so we'll divide the time equally amongst you. Is Brian still here? Brian DeMarco, you're here? Great. So feel free to go ahead and start introducing yourself.
My name is John Blatt. I am with the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. I represent nonprofit groups around the state of Oregon that develop housing that is affordable to people who have low income. I can give you the short version or the very short version. The very short version would start out that the understatement of the day is that this area of law is among the most complicated in statute. We discussed that the hard way. Some of our groups were considering the ability to use co-ops, as they're slightly different than condo associations, but co-ops to help them be able to use some more innovative financing and structuring techniques to provide affordable housing. Essentially, in general terms, a co-op differs from a condo association because in a co-op or in a cooperative real estate venture, you have a corporation that owns the entire property in question, and people buy in by buying shares of the corporation and signing a lease that allows them to occupy one of the units within that within the property. It's a common structure that is used in the East Coast, especially in New York City. It's very common, and they still operate very effectively within New York. It's something that has not been used around here. There have been some changes in federal law recently that I'll talk about in just a minute that make this possibly more useful to us, but also makes our what we need to get out of legislation more complicated. And we have to wait for some things to happen for that to be clear. Essentially, one of the things I want to emphasize today also is that co-ops currently are not prohibited. My understanding that there is at least one co-op housing property operating within the state right now. They have just had to define all the rights and responsibilities of the people involved in the project within their own documentation. So what we had intended to do with this legislation was to put something in statute that made people who might get involved in this, whether it is potential shareholders or potential banks that may want to finance it, to try and make it a little easier and a little more clear about what everyone's rights and responsibilities are, and somewhat reduce the transaction costs so that the banks don't have to get so deeply into all of the documentation. What we discovered when we used the Uniform Commercial Code Commissioner's draft of a model act was that this is a very complicated part of statute. We raised many questions that we did not have answers to when we put the draft together. At the same time, a second thing happened in Congress that both I think is a positive for the potential of developing home ownership for low-income people and also a complicating factor in this legislation. What happened was that Congress added a preference to the major federal financing mechanism for affordable housing, and what they did was of the entity preference for projects that eventually result in tenant ownership. And that can take a couple of different forms. It could take single-family home ownership. It could take a condo association, a kind of advantage, or it could take a co-op. There have been a number of attempts around the country to do single-family home ownership. It has been very problematic. So that the likelihood is that that will not happen. The condo association requires that you have someone to buy every unit within the property, which also is probably not likely when the property rolls over to ownership. So the co-op may offer us a means to roll over these apartment complexes that are being developed into tenant home ownership when that becomes appropriate. The complicating factor is that Congress just made this change in December, and the IRS had originally said that they were going to issue regulations, or not regulations, excuse me, they were going to issue an advice letter very quickly that would give us direction on what would qualify and not qualify a co-op to be part of a home ownership plan eventually. The IRS did not issue that letter, and the latest word we have from our national association is that what they are being told by the IRS is that we need to proceed and just ignore the co-op option for a little while. I think that we are caught up in the turnover within the administration, and so there are people not filling decision-making positions, and the IRS, like all of the other departments, is having to go back and justify all of the rule changes that got in progress before January 20th, and I think those two things are slowing down the process. So we are at a place where I think co-op could be useful to the groups here in Oregon, but it is certainly not clear what we need that co-op legislation to look like from a federal standpoint to make it useful with these federal programs. We have not had an opportunity because of the indecision at the federal level. We did not pursue resolving some of the issues that came up when the bill was drafted, so we have not been able to sit down and figure out what parts of the model legislation we need to have in statute and what parts we need to correct. So I guess I would just say in closing, there's a couple of things that I want to emphasize. One, this could be very useful. The bill in its current form is probably not the best bill that it could be and could be corrected when we have all of the right information, that being the rules from the IRS, and we have a chance to sit down with the real estate agency and the other interested parties and kind of define out what would be the best piece of legislation we could have. And finally, because there is no preclusion on co-ops, delaying this at this point doesn't cause us any difficulty and would allow us to check in with everybody and propose the right piece of legislation.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Blatt?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like you're saying you'll come back to us with a bill when you're ready to.
Yes.
And that this would be a very useful thing to do for affordable housing.
Yes, I believe it is.
Okay, great. I think I look forward to having you come back with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blatt. Mr. DeMarco, if you'd like to testify, please.
Vice Chair's Honor, Vice Chair Rosenbaum. My name is Brian DeMarco. I'm assistant to the commissioner at the Oregon Real Estate Agency. Part of my responsibility at the agency is to administer certain aspects of land development statutes, the Oregon Condominium Act, the Timeshare Act, the Oregon Membership Campgrounds, and the Oregon Subdivision and Series Partition Control Law. The statutory scheme proposed by this bill would fit within that type of statutory scheme. The agency opposes the bill as introduced, but is not opposed to the concept of real estate cooperatives. Part of administering the Oregon Condominium Act and the Timeshare Act, I'm part of the working group that has been bandied about here, and this working group consists of the members Mr. Bennett had mentioned, and I believe Chairman Knope mentioned something about who represents the public interest in this. As a state employee, I feel it is incumbent upon me to represent the public interest in the working group. Mr. Bennett and I have had several confrontations, so to speak, on issues, and we'll continue to have certain confrontation on issues, particularly when I do represent the consumer protection aspect of these legislation. I was here today prepared to give testimony in opposition to the legislation, and I will do so at the pleasure of the committee by submitting the oral and supplementary written testimony, but I'd rather not go through an entire litany of points about why the real estate agency does not like this bill. I'd like to just suffice it to say that there's certain consumer protections that are offered by the comparable regulatory schemes that should be incorporated into this proposed legislation. The bill's provisions and its language are not clear and not concise. I believe a statutory scheme should be clear and concise, otherwise it's ripe for being misconstrued and misapplied. Finally, the bill itself is impossibly broad in its attempt to administer and regulate or register the cooperatives. There are certain aspects that the real estate agency would be involved in that were not spelled out adequately and need to be addressed. I do have a whole list here, and unless the committee would like me to reiterate everything on this list, I would pass and submit to your questions at this time.
Thank you, and we do have the written record of it, and is there any questions for Mr. DeMarco? Representative Merkley, do you have a question?
I do not have a question for Mr. DeMarco.
You're just getting excited? Okay. Thank you very much. I would, again, ask the parties who have an interest, pro or con, in this bill to sit down and work together. We'll find out what amendments you can come up with that, you know, essentially what you can agree on. And we will bring likely two of these bills back at a later date. And hopefully we'll have a third bill that will come to the committee so we can look at the whole issue in total and see if we can't come to some sort of a consensus on this issue. I would like to suggest maybe that you work with Representative Merkley, if he's willing, as sort of our liaison from the committee, and you can keep us apprised on how they're doing. Are you open to that, Representative Merkley?
Yes, sir.
I know Representative Merkley is interested in consumer protection and issues as it relates to homeowners and associations. So if you will all kind of keep in contact with him and keep the committee apprised of what you're up to and how it's going, we would certainly appreciate that. And is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2793? Barbara, did you, you're okay for today?
Good.
All right. With that, anyone else? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2793. Anything else for the good of the committee? Let it be noted that I let you out 5 minutes early, and we'll